Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Well, the professional football season has begun, and already the New York Jets have been mathematically eliminated from the playoffs, and they've only played one regular season game so far. Well, not really, but coming off one of the worst performances in preseason history, it certainly does not look good for that other team from New York. You know, the one that didn't win the Super Bowl, as the Jets have become known. Nonetheless, that doesn't mean the Jets won't be generating any attention in the news. In the offseason, they made a deal to acquire one of the biggest attractions going on in sports right now, Tim Tebow. Noted for leading Florida to two consecutive national championships, but also for his outspoken commitment to his Christian faith. His story, along with the remarkable out-of-nowhere phenomena Jeremy Lin, a professional basketball player who led the terminally pathetic New York Knicks on a wild 7-game winning streak last February, has led to an increased focus on the role of religion in professional sports. To talk about this topic, and perhaps connect it to what it all means for the state of Christianity in America today, I am pleased to be joined by Timothy Dalrymple, the managing editor for the evangelical portal on patheos.com, one of the most popular, if not the most popular, websites devoted to religious discussion on the World Wide Web. But Timothy is not just some run-of-the-mill managing editor at a website. He actually has a fascinating background that makes him an ideal person to reflect upon our topic today. Dr. Dalrymple was a collegiate gymnast at Stanford University, helping his team win the 1995 national championship. Unfortunately, just before the 1996 Olympic trials, he suffered a career-ending neck injury. Nonetheless, Tim took his philosophy and religious studies degree at Stanford on to Princeton Theological Seminary, where he earned a Master's of Divinity, and then, as if to complete the Holy Trinity of Education, he finished off a PhD in religion at Harvard University. He is the recent author of the book Jeremy Lin, The Reason for Linsanity, as well as countless articles on patheos.com. We'll link to all the stuff on our website, so if you're intrigued by what you hear today, we urge you to explore further and deeper into the subject by visiting us at www.researchonreligion.org or going to Timothy's website, patheos.com. Also, please like our Facebook page for continuing updates and discussion about what we're doing here on the show. Hey, Tim, welcome to Research on Religion.
As a longtime fan of this program, it's great to be here.
All right. I want to talk sports and religion with you today and hopefully connect it to what that could tell us about the status of Christianity in America, if that's at all possible. So let's start off by talking sports. Yeah, a lot has been made in the past year of this guy, Tim Tebow, and especially his public celebration of his faith. You know, some might even say that it is an in-your-faith in-your-face promotion of Christianity, almost kind of Christian trash-talking to some extent. Now, a large number of the folks who've been editorializing about Tebow have either never been involved in the life of an elite athlete, nor have they been practicing Christians. And so that is kind of interesting. And this is where I value your insight into the topic, not only because you've written about Jeremy Lin, another figure that's garnered attention for his Christian faith, but because you've lived this life. So I want to dig into your life a little bit, if you don't mind.
Sounds great.
That's good, because if you did mind, then it would have been a real short interview. So, hey, you were a major component of a gymnastics team at Stanford that went on to win the NCAA national title in 1995. That's a big deal. How'd you get to that point? What did it take from your earliest youth to be competing at such a high level?
Well, when I was turning 8, we moved to a new town and just missed the registration deadline for soccer, which I had always been playing. And the 1984 Olympics had just been on the television over that previous summer. And at the 1984 Olympic Games, that was in Los Angeles. That was Mary Lou Retton, and the men's team won the gold. So I was flipping all around the house, and my parents thought that they ought to get me trained in how to do it properly. They also needed some way to get my energy out. So I started taking gymnastics classes and was pretty quickly identified as having Olympic talent.
Let me stop you there. What do you mean by you quickly identified as having Olympic talent? You're 8, 9 years old.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, I was able to do all of my splits the day that I walked into the gym. My shoulders were abnormally flexible. I could put my hands together in front and with straight arms move my arms all the way around to the back and all the way around to the front again. And so I was very flexible. I was a little stronger than most kids my age. And it all seemed to come fairly naturally to me. I won a state title when I was 10 and went on to win my first junior national all-round title when I was 15.
Wow. So, I mean, are people, like, on the sidelines there, you walk in the first day of gymnastics class or, you know, you've been there a couple months and, you know, there's somebody watching from the sidelines saying, dude, you have talent. We're taking you to the next level. Are those people, like, sitting around the gym looking for people like that?
Well, the coaches, they certainly have their eyes open, and it's not terribly difficult. I mean, I can spot, if I walk into any gym, I can usually, by the end of a single practice, tell you who has the potential. And some element of that calculation will come from their physical stature. If you're able to see the parents and what the parents look like and their proportions and so forth. And some people who don't have the ideal gymnastics build can still be good at particular events. But there is a certain build that's more or less required if you're going to be a good all-around gymnast. And then, of course, just strength, flexibility, and coordination. I mean, gymnastics requires a kind of all-around athleticism.
Yeah, it is absolutely an amazing sport. And, you know, I know a lot of people say, gymnastics, that's just kind of rolling around on a mat. But, I mean, the athletes involved in that, I mean, have to be strong everywhere, you know, all around, the flexibility, the strength, you do the rings and that kind of stuff. I mean, that's absolutely amazing. And I actually have to, you know, mention that my faith has been restored in God by the fact that you didn't go down a soccer path. You know, because soccer's not one of my big sports. So, yeah, you know, there is a God here saving people from soccer, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, well, I think gymnastics is one of the great amateur sports that really still holds to that amateur ideal. And it's still possible to, you know, once you're finished with your Olympic experience, to have some professional life. But it's largely, I would say, 95% an amateur sport.
Mm-hmm.
And very much oriented around the Olympics. So kids in the sport of gymnastics, that's the sine qua non of gymnastics accomplishment.
Yeah, and that, you know, that brings me up to this issue of how you get to that point, the training. So you walk in the gym, you're 8 or 9 years old, somebody says, wow, you know, you got what it takes here. What happens then? I mean, are you training every single day, and are you going to specialty camps? One of the things that really amazed me about listening to the story of the gymnastics competitors at the Olympics, especially the women's team, was just the intense level of dedication that took to get from that point when you first walk into the gym and say, hey, I want to try this, to the Olympics, right? I think of Gabby Douglas, who I think she was living somewhere on the East Coast, North Carolina or Georgia somewhere, and she moved away from her family to train in a gym in Iowa. I mean, like, whoa, is that what's going on here at this level?
It's very common. By the time you're an elite gymnast, you probably train 6 to 8 hours every day on weekdays and probably a slightly lesser number of hours on a Saturday. I know by the time I was 12, I was training 6 days a week. And certainly going to national team camps, they identify gymnasts with that kind of potential very early and do everything that they can to cultivate your gymnastics talent throughout your childhood. So moving is common as well. I mean, Bella Caroli has his camp, and a lot of young girls will move there. In her case, she moved to the gym of Liang Chao, who was the coach for Sean Johnson. And in my case, it wasn't a long move by any stretch. My coach lived about an hour away from my home. But I would live there usually for stretches of 2 to 3 days, twice a week.
Wow. And you said you were on weekdays training 6 to 8 hours?
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, you know, I can see that in the summertime, right? Kids don't have anything to do. But during when you got school in session, and I mean, that must really put kids under a pressure cooker.
Yeah, and a lot of gymnasts, myself included, they have to find some creative approach to schooling. So I did independent study. It wasn't homeschooling exactly. My parents were not my teachers, but I would go into the high school once a week for about an hour and take my tests and hand in my assignments at that point. But largely I was on my own. And so, you know, fortunately, gymnasts tend to be fairly disciplined and self-starters. So if you're serious about your academia, your academics, which most gymnasts actually are, mm-hmm. It's one of the sports that people tend to do well academically as well, then you'll find a solution to make it work. But having that time in the gym is important. And you mentioned the summer, but the summers actually be more like 10, sometimes 10, 11, 12 hours in the gym. Not necessarily all of it, you know, intensely training, but you'd be in the gym an awful lot.
Let me ask about that psychologically, too, because, you know, as a kid growing up, I was just a typical dumb old kid that, you know, would run around and play in vacant lots and chase frogs in a pond or something like that. But, you know, here you're talking 6 to 8 hours during the school year, 10 hours during the summer. I mean, you seem to be putting all your chips onto one aspect of your life, right? That this is gymnastics. I'm really good at this. This is the career trajectory that I'm on. Does that affect people psychologically?
Absolutely. You know, I have two daughters. One is will be one in a couple weeks. The other is just now turning 4. And I do not really want my daughters to go into gymnastics. I would be happy for them to do it recreationally. I fear that they would find that they're very good at it and that they would want to stay and to do it seriously. And I do think that there are very legitimate concerns that parents ought to take into mind, especially for women. And that's not being sexist. It's just recognizing the differences in the sport, that female gymnasts tend to peak around 16. And right now, 16 to 18 is maybe your the peak of your competitive career. For men, it's often more like 20 to 26 or 22 to 26. So men are able to have more of the childhood experience, more regular social lives growing up, and the way in which it affects women and their bodies is different as well. Psychologically, it's you certainly find, you know, and I traveled internationally with the national team to compete and sometimes with the female gymnasts as well. And you certainly do find that they lead quite a sheltered existence and are not necessarily as kind of socially conditioned as others. And that has its negatives, but it also does have some positives to it. And there are a lot of things that they're also protected from that may not be the best influences. So it's a mixed bag, but it's certainly a powerful psychological experience.
Yeah, and, you know, I can imagine this too, you know, where you're talking about women gymnasts, their careers peaking 16, 18. For men, it's in their early 20s. And, you know, but after you're done with that, you're done. I mean, there's no, for, like you say, that's a largely amateur sport. There's, you know, one or two people can kind of go on and get television announcing careers related to it, but I mean, after you're done, you're done, and so you put all your chips onto this one thing, and you know what happens then.
Well, take Allie Reisman, for instance, who is one of the, I believe she was the captain of the team in at the most recent Olympics in London. She's 18, and she will. She had a great Olympics, did very well for herself. Was very pleased. I think everybody was very pleased to see her win the gold medal on the floor exercise in the last event. And then she went, she will go on a tour, a post-Olympics tour, a kind of, I think, Kellogg's Champions Tour, something like that. And they'll go to 40-some different cities. There is sometimes a second tour. She'll have some endorsement opportunities. After that, you know, she'll probably go to college and compete at a college level. So for women, there is kind of this gymnastic second life. For men, it's still your college years are in your prime or leading toward your prime. For women, it's kind of a second life where you're not quite at your peak. You're still able to compete well at the college level, not necessarily internationally. But that can be a lot of fun. and it can pay for your college.
Right.
And then that's probably the end.
One of the things that, you know, talking about the psychological makeup of the elite athlete and, you know, the intense training that you go around, and especially if you're really good, you get a lot of people that are surrounding you and say, man, you know, kid, you're going on. That's great. How do you deal with this? And we had a podcast about a year ago or so with a guy named Eric Carter, and he was a scholar, and he talked to a number of professional football players about the role that religious faith played in their life. And I want to kind of explore that, how it played in your life. Did you grow up in a religious household? Were you a fairly regular churchgoer kind of person?
I was, yeah, absolutely. My father is a pastor, grandfather a pastor. So I was raised in non-denominational California evangelical churches.
Mm-hmm. And how did that play out in your gymnastics career? Because again, you're doing this very intensive training. You're gone on weekends. And was still Sunday church time, or did that start to fade as your career started really taking off?
Well, unless there was a competition, then Sunday was certainly church time, and there were no other excuses.
Your dad is a pastor, after all, right? You can't miss dad's sermons, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
My gymnastics, the gym for me was a great laboratory of faith. It was absolutely central to the development of my faith throughout my childhood. It was an arena where I was regularly challenged and often terrified, prayed more than anywhere else in my life. When my gymnastics career ended, it felt as though 95% of my prayer life was amputated, because that had been the place where I had regularly called out to God and regularly found God's provision, God's presence, God's sustenance. For me, they were very integrally related. That's why when I began my current role with Pathios, that I began interviewing athletes of faith and eventually ended up interviewing Jeremy, amongst others, Jeremy Lin, because I do think it's fascinating the ways in which your athletic life shapes your spiritual life and your spiritual life shapes your athletic life. I was a different gymnast because I was Christian, and I was a different Christian because I was a gymnast. Both of them shaped one another in complex, but I think very important, and in most cases, very beneficial ways.
Explain that a little bit more, and also explain your prayer life as an athlete. Is this to a typical American, or perhaps a person who doesn't go to church very much, they see the athletes praying? I mean, is this prayer like, you know, dear Lord, please let me get a score of nine on the, you know, parallel bars today, and there'll be if you do that, you know, I promise to go to church extra hard next week, or put an extra $10 bill in the collection plate? Or is there some other aspect of that your prayer life and faith plays in helping you through the difficult times or the good times even of your athletic career?
I think there's an unfair tendency for non-athletes, and especially those who regard sports with some degree of scorn, to assume that the spiritual lives of athletes are superficial. So there was a piece that came out, I believe it was in Slate, after the London Olympics, reflecting on one of the things that Gabby Douglas, who won the all-around for the girls, said. And it just kind of assumed that she had this transactional mentality that if I am a good little Christian girl, then God will bless me with sports glory. And, you know, I think all children raised in church will have some tendency to think, if I'm a good Christian, then God will bless me. I don't find that more frequent amongst athletes. And amongst athletes, like with others, I find that as they grow older, they grow out of that kind of view of God as some kind of cosmic Pez dispenser who's going to just give me the things that I want. For me, as I was approaching competitions, and I know I'm biased here, but gymnastics is one of the few sports where you're regularly in danger of catastrophic injury. So you're not likely to break your back playing tennis, right, just because you're upright all the time. In gymnastics, you're flipping and twisting, you know, high up in the air, often over equipment, and it's there are an awful lot of spinal injuries.
Yeah.
So, you know, these were things I grew up seeing people peel off the high bar and break their neck and get pulled out of the gym on a stretcher. So you see these things. And for me, competitions were always scary. I would, on the way, as we were driving to the competitions, this was in the San Francisco area, I would fantasize that maybe there will be some kind of earthquake that will prevent the competition and I won't have to compete today.
Mm-hmm.
So I prayed regularly just for God's peace and presence. I knew that whatever else happened, whether I did well or whether I fell on my face, as long as I had that sense of God's peace and presence, the rest didn't really matter. I could handle the rest if I had God. As I interview other gymnasts, I do find a sort of a similar attitude. Sometimes I think it's put rather crudely that, well, I needed some source of peace. I needed God, some way to kind of hold it all together. I don't want to make it sound like God was a crutch, because it was much more than that. You mentioned victory and people saying how great you are. Sports, one of the most interesting aspects of sports, I think, spiritually, is that it does teach you your nothingness. I mean, it teaches you your weakness. You have to be defeated tons and tons of times before you're going to be victorious, and you need to get through that. So sports is very humbling. When I was preparing for the book on Jeremy Lin, I interviewed Tony Dungy, who's the coach, Super Bowl-winning NFL head coach, who's written a couple books on his faith and is famous for his faith. And he said that he thought faith was more important, not for helping athletes deal with defeat, because sports itself will teach you that, but for helping athletes deal with victory and glory. Because all too quickly, that's the thing that will take a great athlete down. You begin to think so highly of yourself that you don't need to train, you don't need to listen to your coaches, you don't need to work as hard as the other guys. It will keep you humble even in the midst of victory, and I really found that to be the case. My greatest victories were my most humbling experiences, because in many cases I knew that it was divine provision. I knew that God had helped me through. I knew that the smallest of mistakes could have taken it all away. So coming away from it, those were extremely affirming of my faith and very humbling.
Yeah, you make a great point there. And this, again, came up with the discussion with Eric Carter and a lot of football players who get catapulted to fame and fortune rather quickly. And, you know, again, you have people around you telling you can do no wrong, and it becomes very difficult how to handle victory. But on the other hand, you know, what you mentioned, I find, and I try teaching my students this too. I get a lot of straight A students who come to me and they haven't had academic difficulties any time in their life. And I said, you know, listen, it's good to fail every so often, because you know your limitations, and that is really important. And the real big danger is being that straight A student, being that elite athlete who's told all the time that you're absolutely perfect, because you lose sense of who you are in the greater realm of the cosmos, I guess.
Yeah. No, I think seeing your own horizon is absolutely essential to a healthy spiritual life. If you don't come to the end of yourself, there's a sense in which you never really learn to trust in God and find God's provision and the ability that God gives you to do things greater than you could do on your own, those kind of reservoirs of strength that run far deeper than your own. So that was it's hard to overstate the value of that experience, and yet it was had time and time again throughout my gymnastics career. When I won my first national title at 15, throughout the entire competition, it was almost, I hate to use the phrase out-of-body experience, but it felt very much like I was simply observing something that was happening, and I could see it coming together. It was beautiful, the way in which God provided. I don't think that God provided because I was a good Christian. I think God has his own purposes for these things, and when I failed, then I was pretty ready to chalk that up to God as well. And God ordained that. That's perfectly fine. Then again, I want to, for younger gymnasts, there is kind of the regular kind of gymnastics competitions that you see on the television. We also had something called national skills testing, which would determine who's on the national team for half of the year, and then the other competition, the USA Junior National Championships, would determine who's on the national team for the second half of the year. I went to a national skills testing competition and had a severely sprained ankle. This was, I was 16 or 17 at the time, and I could barely walk up to the event. And yet, whenever it came my turn to do something, and somehow it all worked out and came to the end, and I won that competition, and it was profoundly humbling. I don't know if I'd ever been so grateful and so humbled and so joyful all at once.
It's interesting that you say that, and I think a lot of people who watch the sports, watch the Olympics, watch the NFL, the NBA from the outside, really don't understand that, you know, how much these elite athletes who are always on the top of your fantasy football league are still experiencing a lot of their limitations and failures and the humility that goes along with it. One thing I do want to ask you about is the team at Stanford and what it was like in the locker room, especially with regards to your Christian faith. You know, so you're a strong Christian, you're there. Not everybody is perhaps like that. Is there some ministering that goes on in the locker room, or did you just kind of keep your faith to yourself? Did you have teammates that say, oh man, you know, I know Tim is a really strong Christian. I'm having some struggles here. I'm gonna go talk to Tim. Or was that not the dynamic?
Well, first on your last point, I want to follow up on that and say that when people hear an athlete say, I give God the glory for this victory,
mm-hmm.
I often hear some of the Snyder commenters say, something along the lines that the athlete thinks they deserved the victory because they're a Christian or something like
right.
that. And if you think you deserved it, you're not really all that likely to give thanks for it. I mean, you can thank your boss for paying you, but your boss is kind of giving you what you've earned. In most cases, I've found in my conversations with athletes who are believers, it's really that conviction that you didn't deserve this that's part of what's so humbling and part of why you're so thankful. So when people hear that, I hope they understand that there's a profound sense of unworthiness for this great victory, this great thing that happened in your life, as you're so aware of your own sinfulness, so aware of how there are a lot of people out there who are just as good as you, and maybe, you know, things just didn't turn out quite right for them. But on the point with the team and the locker room atmosphere, although we didn't really have a locker room, it was all in the gym, there were some who, especially when I got to college, who were not too enthused about the fact that I was an evangelical Christian and who came with preconceptions about that. And so, teased, sometimes good-naturedly, sometimes less so. Then there were quite a few others who may have been raised with kind of some Christian influences, but it was not a big part of their life. And so it was always my intention and my hope to talk with them about significant things, and they knew that this was a central part of my life. So it was common for me to bring them along, and of course they came happily once we got to know each other, to fellowship meetings or to Bible studies and things of that nature. And had a lot of really meaningful conversations with my teammates. And, you know, I'm not in a position to judge what kind of effect that had on their spiritual lives, but many of them are doing very well, and there's just been very meaningful relationships.
It's interesting because, especially in terms of gymnastics, but I think this is true for other sports, you know, you were a team at Stanford that you were all cheering for one another to win that national championship, and so your participation affected somebody else, so you had some degree of camaraderie. But on the other hand, you know, following the 1995 national championships, you know, the Olympic trials were coming up, and there's only so many slots that are out there, and you are going to end up competing against the people who are on your team. And that must raise a little bit of tension amongst the team too. And the reason I say this is when, you know, we start talking about Jeremy Lin and thinking about that too. Yeah. Everybody on the Knicks wants the Knicks to win, but you know, everybody wants to be the star who wins the game or get a lot more playing time on the court. And so that must create a very interesting, tense dynamic.
Yeah. You know, gymnastics is rarely a team sport. It's largely individual. You do, when you go to competitions as with your club or your high school team, if you have one, then you do compete as a team, but it's kind of an afterthought. Maybe it was just me. And maybe I was just so self-centered, I don't know. But I don't think so, because you would compete there as a club. Then if you went on to state championships, you might compete as a club there. And but then you compete as a state team at the regional level and as a regional team at the national level and then as a national team. So your teams are always changing. And there's not a whole lot of opportunity until the college level to really bond as a team over the long term. Whenever we had national team camps, you know, there were sports psychologists who would come and talk with us about kind of the team dynamic and how you can be better as a team than you are as individuals. But it's only rarely a team sport. Certainly when you get to a place like the Olympics and you have the opportunity to win a team title, then that's a big deal, and you're going to be very serious about that. But, you know, I hope this doesn't sound Pollyanna-ish, but I never felt a great deal of tension amongst my teammates when it came to competing for those spots on the Olympic team. I did train with Jair Lynch, who was one of the top guys on the 1996 Olympic team, and Josh Stein, who was the alternate to that team. So there were other guys, and there were others in addition to them and myself who were training for the 1996 Olympic trials. And, you know, we knew that there were only so many spots. And if it came down to it and we were fighting over the last spot at the Olympic trials, I'm sure there would have been, you know, you're kind of rooting with half of your heart, and with half of your heart you're hoping it doesn't work out, you know. But we never, in the midst of training, there was just an awful lot of trying to help one another get better and hoping that you could beat the other guys out and take all the spots for yourself.
Now, you were talking about training for the 1996 Olympics, and a big part of your story that I didn't know about until looking up your biography recently was that you suffered a very, very serious gymnastics accident right before then, which, you know, basically you broke your neck, and that was the end of the career. You know, I assume that your career was riding high, and then this just occurs out of nowhere. Now, you had mentioned earlier, you know, this is something that you always have on the back of your mind, is you see other people wheeled out on a stretcher and, you know, sometimes wonder, wow, if that's me, what, you know, what happens? Tell us what was going on when all of this occurred in your life. I mean, there must be kind of a big rush just competing for the 1996 Olympics. That's something that you saw when you were 8 years old and you're almost there. And then your life takes a 180-degree turn the opposite direction. What's happening with you at this time?
Yeah, I had always targeted the 96 games and the 2000 games as the two where my opportunities were the greatest. 96, I would have been 20. It would have been at the very, you know, I would have been the youngest person on the team. So it would have been my chances for 2000, if I had stayed around and stayed healthy, would have been very, very good. For 96, it was still a bit of a stretch. So it was by no means a given that I would have made the team that year, but I was listed as a top prospect, and everything was coming together beautifully. I was training for this. There was a dual meet, a competition against San Jose State in San Jose, and we drove down for that. And it was in warm-ups when I fell off the high bar and broke my neck, and broke it pretty badly. I never lost feeling or mobility. So miraculously, my spinal cord was preserved, but the spinal column was badly damaged. I had two vertebrae that were in pieces. But I didn't know it, because it wasn't terribly painful at first. And I was still able to move everything and feel everything. So it just felt like a small hot water balloon had burst inside my neck. It felt strange more than it felt painful. And that's partly because the number, you know, nerve endings were severed and the violence of that landing. So I went ahead and I jumped back up on the high bar and took another turn to warm up. And you don't want to let that fear fester. So did that, went over and warmed up on the floor exercise. The competition started. I competed on our first event, which was the pommel horse. By that point, it was getting painful enough that I thought it would be wise to withdraw. And it was not, fortunately, it was not an important competition. Otherwise, I probably would have continued.
Mm-hmm.
It was still, I had planned to go home with my parents for a couple of days, and I wanted to do that, so I did. And it was obvious quickly that there was something gravely wrong. But I didn't want to go to my hometown hospital. Believe me, you wouldn't either, with a serious problem. So I waited until I got back to Stanford. So it was a couple of days later when I walked into the hospital and told them I needed to get an X-ray. And once the doctor saw it, they just flipped out. They ran into the room, said, "Sit up straight, look straight forward, and don't move."
Whoa.
Back out. And then they ran back in and put a brace on my neck and ran back out. Ran back in the third time and said, "Okay, well, we need to admit you to the hospital right away." I said, "Okay." I got up and reached for my backpack, and they said, "No, no, no." They practically tackled me and put me in a wheelchair. And, you know, before I knew it, they were putting a halo into my head, and that's a kind of metallic band that they screw into your skull. They attach it to a cable that they run over a pulley at the end of the bed, and they add weights until it can pull everything out straight. Once you're in there, then you're stable at least. You're out of danger. And we decided to have a fusion surgery. It was obvious to me that the 96 Olympics, this was about 4 months prior to the Olympic trials, were no longer going to happen. And it was obvious to me that quite probably my gymnastics career was over. But I have to say, so that was, you know, of course, that was devastating. But I came away from the whole experience because it was the most profound experience of a divine presence and love that I had to that point ever known throughout that entire hospital stay. Some people, I just say this sometimes, but I mean, some people, you know, you have your mountaintop experience in, on mountaintops in the Old Testament stories, but I had mine in the Stanford Hospital where God really met me in a profound way, and I came away from that. And that entire experience, stretching out for weeks and months afterward, very encouraged, because it, at the same time as I learned that my neck was broken, I learned that I was spared from quadriplegia, which I really should have been rendered quadriplegic by this injury. And it was high enough that I would not have been able to breathe. So the doctor himself, you know, the secular doctor, was talking to the newspapers and using the word miracle to say that it's unbelievable that he, given the severity of the injury, how badly everything was broken and how violent it would have had to be to make that happen, it's a miracle that he's still able to walk. And so I felt saved more than I felt cursed. There was not a why me moment so much as there was a sense that God had delivered me from something much worse. And in the midst of my dark valley, to the extent that it was, God was very present with me.
Yeah, that's very interesting, because I was going to ask you if there was that why me, woe is me kind of thing. But again, you know, I guess the nature of the injury saying, you know, hey, you know, you should have not gotten off that mat the moment you fell, but you did and were walking around a few days. Something must have been talking to you saying, you know, I need you for something else here, Timothy. You got to stick around for a bit.
Well, I went 2 weeks after I left the hospital, and I'm wearing my neck brace. No, actually, it wasn't that. It was actually, as I was leaving the hospital, we went to see a movie on the way home. And I'm up and I'm walking around and I'm with my parents, and we go to see this movie called Restoration that starred Robert Downey Jr. And he plays a monk, and at one point in the movie he approaches this monastery, and on the monastery door are the words, "Behold, I have refined you in the furnace of affliction." And I was really impacted by those words. It felt as though God was present with me in the same way that he was present with the friends of Daniel in that fiery furnace. But also it felt like some kind of promise that God had a purpose in this, to refine me for his own use, because the rest of that verse goes on to say it is for my sake that I do this. And that's something that may, you know, strike non-Christians as bizarre. Behold, I have refined you in the furnace of affliction. It is for my own namesake that I do this. But it was something that, if you love God, something that you can rejoice in, that you are being refined for some purpose. So I was greatly encouraged by that. And the injury, it freed up a lot of time that had formerly gone to gymnastics, of course.
And yeah, no 10-hour training days. I mean, yeah, wow.
Yeah. So I was able to go on some missions trips and get involved in the college fellowships and leadership there. A lot of things that I never would have been able to do, and things that turned out to be very, very important.
And so this takes your career in a different direction, and I just want to spend a little bit of time briefly here before we get on to talk about Jeremy Lin and have you reflect upon his life based upon your experience in elite athletics. After your gymnastic career was over, you took off for some advanced degrees. And, you know, this is not surprising. You're a bright guy, intense dedication and motivation. You're the kind of ideal person that you would want in graduate school. You do put in those 10-hour days or 12-hour days. So, yeah, I'm not going to ask you much about what went on there, but you earned the MDiv at Princeton and then a PhD from Harvard. Again, you're at the top of your game. You got a PhD from Harvard in hand, and you could have gone into the academic professorial route at some other university, but you chose a different path and became connected with Pathios. So what's that about?
Well, for me, like a lot of athletes, after your career is over, there's a kind of identity crisis where for a long time, you thought of yourself in a certain way, and even, you know, I was always very committed to my own intellectual development and my own spiritual development, and I prioritized those well above my physical and athletic development. But even for me, when gymnastics was gone, it was just a profound challenge to my identity, something that I had thought was not really, you know, that important to me. Turned out that it really was, and it played into my pride that it was something that made me different from everybody else and made me exceptional. And maybe it plays into that pride a little further that after that injury and when it became clear that my career was over, and I did have chronic pain, and I don't want to make it sound as though, and still do, and don't want to make it sound as though it was all roses. You know, there were tough times as well. But I had a conversation with one of my teammates who said, you know, you excelled at gymnastics, and now it's just time to excel at something else. And I thought that was right. You know, it's time to take the things that I had learned and apply that in some other area and really pursue with all my heart and soul and mind the other things that I thought were important. So I had always thought that I wanted to be a compelling and hopefully a winsome voice within the secular university, and so I studied religion and philosophy and wanted to become very well trained in those things and be able to be a resource for students in a secular university setting. I felt as though my experiences and my chronic pain gave me an opportunity to study the issue of suffering in a way that perhaps with greater urgency. Not necessarily greater insight. I don't know if, you know, I have any kind of special insight by virtue of the fact that I have chronic pain or went through this. But it's certainly something that matters to me. And so that could be viewed as accidental or tangential to my life or as something essential to my purpose and kind of welcome that into my vocation. So I decided that I would focus on studying suffering and the theology of suffering. So I went through all of that. And it was always my intention for the things that I studied to be taken into the public square, not merely in the ivory tower, but into the public square, to reach as broad an audience as possible. By the time I was nearing the end of my PhD program, I was frustrated with academia. As you mentioned, I was at Harvard, where the political elements are very, very strong, where it sometimes feels, And I have great respect for my own advisor, Sarah Coakley, one of the great theologians in the world, and for a number of the other professors I work with, but it often feels as though people are kind of just working out their own prejudices intellectually. And they're, you know, there are people who left their faith when they were teenagers, and they're spending their entire academic career justifying that decision. Kind of elaborate exercises in justifying what you already want to believe. I felt out of place and that I really believed in the classical academic ideals of the disinterested pursuit of truth and treating every viewpoint with great charity and making sure that you can represent it accurately and fairly before you go on to criticize it. These were the things I was passing on to my students, and yet they didn't seem to be kind of the dominant forces within academia. at the same time, I was frustrated with evangelical participation and representation in the public square. I felt that evangelicals do not represent themselves well on kind of the great public issues of the day, and that evangelicals can and should model a better kind of conversation. So there were a couple other Harvard-affiliated people who were involved with building Pathos. The founder went to Harvard as an undergrad. The person who was my immediate boss, the vice president of content, was also a doctoral student at Harvard. And so an email went out to the doctoral student list and inviting anybody who was interested to apply. And this was at the same time as the economy was tanking, and it was kind of a scary time within academia. But I was just no longer convinced that that was really where I wanted to go. There were some opportunities. It's not as though I had no choice. But I thought, you know, here's an opportunity to jump into the public square, to be a part of the conversations that day by day are shaping this society, and potentially to really create a fantastic religion website that would have a great influence. When we first started, that seemed like it was an awful long way off. You know, our first month, we had a bit of a bump because there was a Time article about us, but otherwise, you know, we had like 20,000 visits within the first month.
Mm-hmm.
And last month, I think we had 5 or 6 million visits.
Yeah. No, you guys have really exploded onto the scene in the last 5 years or so. Yeah.
Yeah. BeliefNet was kind of the 800-pound gorilla in the space when we started. And yet they were moving in the direction of a kind of Dr. Phil or Oprah-fied spirituality. And that's fine. You know, that's where they felt like they could find their business model. We really wanted to create a kind of WebMD of religion was the initial vision, that we would be the trusted advisor within this space, the place you go when you need answers to what does X believe or what does it mean that, you know, the Pope says Y. So we built a library of information on over 100 different religious traditions and sects. But around that, we built a series of portals, or they've had different names over time. First, we called them gateways. Now we call them channels, that were buy-in for members of particular religious communities. And once we started recruiting bloggers and columnists for each of those portals, then they really took off. And those portals became, I'd say, kind of the great source of vitality at Pathos. So rather than kind of glomming around a vague kind of spirituality, we're more of a solar system with multiple centers of gravity, and each one can grow up and be a player within its own media space.
Yeah, no, that's very cool. I got to ask this, though, because you said it started out calling them gateways, then it's portals, and now it's channels. What's all the different names about? They do this at the university, too. They change the office names like every 2 years. I can never figure out where I'm going.
Yeah, you know, their purpose and their nature just changes over time. We had initially thought that they would primarily be points of access for people to get into the library material, and so gateway, we went with that. Eventually, for a long time, we called them portals, and so a lot of Pathos employees still call them portals because they are more similar to like the big portals like MSN.com or Yahoo.com, places that develop their own content as well as kind of point outward to great content elsewhere. Now we rarely point out to great content elsewhere. We're mostly developing our own content and hosting a lot of bloggers, and so we decided to move it to channels, partly also because we initially had a bunch of religious tradition defined portals. So there was the evangelical, Catholic, progressive Christian, Muslim, Buddhist, etc. But now we have channels that are more oriented around particular topics or people groups, like Family Channel, movies, news and politics. And it didn't seem quite right to call those portals. We needed a broader term, and so we decided to go with channels. But it all has to do with the evolution of the product over time as you find what works.
Yeah, and I want to tell people to go visit Pathos.com if you haven't already, because it is a tremendous resource and also very visually appealing. It's a fun website to actually be on and explore. So, but what I want to do now is I want to get back to athletics, and I want to talk about your book on Jeremy Lin. And I mean, this is the classic, you know, kid from nowhere does good storyline. It's a Rudy type of story. You could just see a Walt Disney movie coming out soon with this guy. And you know, it burst forth in a 7-game win streak in the mid part of February of 2012 with the Knicks. However, this guy was on your radar screen long before that, if I'm correct. And you got interest in his story. How so? Was there some kind of Harvard connection that, you know, you were a student athlete, but now you're at Harvard and you hung around with the student athletes and there's this Jeremy Lin guy at Harvard playing basketball? Or how did this connection with Jeremy Lin come about?
Well, yeah, so Jeremy was very active within the Christian community at Harvard. And here's this Asian-American Christian basketball Harvard superstar, which is a very strange combination of words. But for that reason, he was regarded as an object of considerable curiosity, as you might imagine, especially in his junior and senior years as he really began to achieve some stunning victories in competitions against teams like UConn and Boston College, Boston University. So it was in 2009, the same year that I graduated, that I started working with Pathios, and pretty quickly started to hear, you know, there's this Asian-American basketball guy who's a Christian. You really ought to interview him. And I was hearing this from mutual friends within the Christian fellowship world there at Harvard. So I reached out. It was not difficult. You know, I was still teaching at Harvard at the time, even though I was done with my degree. And so I reached out and arranged to get together. We got together one dark and stormy night, literally, and he came out to find me because I couldn't find where the right entrance into his dorm, the house there at Harvard. And we went in and had a pretty extensive conversation about faith and sports, a lot of the same things that you and I just talked about. Jeremy is, in a lot of ways, he's not, even apart from his athletic prowess, he's not the typical Harvard student. I would not say that Jeremy is an intellectual, for instance. He's very bright, but he doesn't like to read, for instance. So you talk to Jeremy, and it sounds much more like you're talking to, you know, a regular athlete than you're talking to an Ivy League student. But Jeremy, don't be fooled by that. He's a very thoughtful person, and before we got together, he had, you know, I had, in introducing myself, I had said, you know, I'm also an athlete of faith, and I linked to an article where I had told my story. And when we got together, he had read it and very carefully and had interesting comments. So we had a great conversation that after that, I really thought, you know, this is a guy that I ought to keep tabs on because there's something special about him. And everybody knew about his great potential at that point, whether he was actually going to be able to live that out or achieve it at the highest level. There were a lot of doubters still.
He went on, go ahead. Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, there's a lot of doubters. He might have been a great basketball player, but, I mean, he's from Harvard. Where does Harvard graduate great basketball players? So I can imagine that, you know, after he graduates, he says, okay, time for the NBA draft. And the NBA draft is a very limited draft. Not a lot of people get drafted into that. And, you know, so what happens to him there? He doesn't get drafted. So how does he end up in a Knicks uniform?
Yeah, there are only a couple rounds to the NBA draft as opposed to something like baseball where it seems like there are endless rounds, right? So I'm not the most inclined to play the race card kind of person. I don't do that very often, but I think the racial element can't be overlooked here either, that Jeremy simply did not look like what people expected future basketball stars to look like.
Right.
He was, in high school, a skinny Asian kid who was 6 foot and then 6'2". You know, when he entered high school, he was 5'2". And I think it was 125 pounds or something like that. I mean, he was kind of a spaghetti-armed. I've seen the pictures. A spaghetti-armed little Asian kid who was very cocky on the basketball court and extremely skilled. everybody would get onto the court with him expecting him to do nothing, and then he would dominate. And he just grew up with this great passion for the sport that he got from his father, and this extraordinary degree of discipline and commitment and training that he got from his mother. So he was, even though he led his high school team, Palo Alto High School, to a state title in his senior year, he was largely overlooked. He was not recruited by the big teams, including California teams, including Stanford, that was right across the street, literally right across the street from where he played all his high school games. And he, Harvard was one school that showed interest, and so he went there. And then coming out of Harvard, kind of a similar situation. Nobody really showed that much interest. They did have, I think it was about 6-7 teams did have him out to camps where they kind of assess prospects. And he came away from those feeling like, you know, I played just as well, if not better, than the others who were there, but it just didn't seem like they were paying attention. I'm not kind of getting a fair look. And so he wasn't drafted, but he played in a summer league where coaches kind of get to take another look, and he played extremely well against the very top draftee, John Wall. So it is an amazing story. It's very much a Rudy kind of story. If Rudy went on not only to play in one play, but to, or I guess it was two plays at the very end of a game in one game, but to, you know, explode and be enormously productive with a professional team and become a worldwide phenomenon.
Mm-hmm. And so he, I think if he originally got picked up by Golden State, right?
That's right, his hometown team.
And then, you know, he just kind of kicked around there and then ended up with the Knicks. And I think the reason he ended up playing on the Knicks was, I can't remember the guy's name. I'm not a big NBA fan. So, you know, one of their superstars got hurt, and they say, okay, well, we got a losing season anyway, so let's put in the, you know, the scrawny Asian kid that we picked up. What the heck, right? And this was, February 10th or something like that of this past year. What happens then?
Well, yeah, so he's drafted by, or not drafted, but signed by the Warriors after he played that great game against John Wall. And his first season, his rookie season, they hardly play him at all. They send him down to the Development League three times, which is the maximum number of times you can go down to the Developmental League as an NBA player. And then he's dropped at the beginning of the second season, goes to Houston, dropped again, goes to New York, and the first thing they do is send him to the back down to the Development League. So he's getting, you know, frustrated. And after Houston dropped him, you know, he thought it might well be over.
Mm-hmm.
If the Knicks dropped him, which it looked like they were going to on February 10th or 11th, I believe it was, then he again thought, you know, maybe it's just time to stop doing basketball. I keep running into all these brick walls, and maybe it's a sign. So there was a deadline coming up when teams had to drop players if they didn't want to guarantee their contracts, and it was quite likely that he was going to be dropped because they had a number of players who were coming back from injury. But they do. They put him in on February 4th after it's their third game in a three-game back-to-back-to-back series. And everybody's tired, everybody's exhausted, and so they put him in at the toward the end of the first quarter. And it didn't happen immediately. People sometimes forget this. I mean, he played well, but not extraordinarily in the first half. But he just got better and better and better as the quarters went on. And he ended that game with 25 points and 7 assists. And everybody left that night just abuzz at what had happened. They thought, wow, this is amazing. This kind of back-of-the-bench player comes in, this Asian-American from Harvard, and has this brilliant night. It'll never happen again.
Mm-hmm. And those are the kind of stories that sports fans often cheer for, right? When you got a team that's not doing too well, or when a team's really great, you want the guy who's the 11th man on the bench to come off and play, and when he makes that first shot, or the fans explode. Yeah, so I can see that, but that's usually a flash in the pan. You're like, okay, that happened once.
And Jeremy had for somebody who hardly ever played, he had a large contingent of followers because he was Asian American, because he was from Harvard. There are a lot of young professionals from Harvard in New York City, and
go figure.
Many of them Christian too,
yeah,
for that matter. So Ivy League Asian Americans in New York loved Jeremy, just as a lot of his hometown crowd in the San Francisco area when he played for Golden State loved him there. But yeah, everybody thought, you know, it was great. They're kind of leaving Madison Square Garden. We saw this extraordinary thing. Certainly it won't happen again. Then, you know, he plays the second game, and he plays even better and scores even more. And surely it's not going to happen a third time, but it happens a third time. And he has this amazing seven-game series where he leads the Knicks to seven straight wins. And he's breaking records for the total number of points scored by a first-time starter over three games and four games and five games. And he's winning, you know, he scored 38 points against the Los Angeles Lakers and Kobe Bryant, the most famous player in the world. And then he has a last-second, you know, game-winning three-point shot against Toronto. And his name is just exploding around the world, and millions of people are starting to follow his social networks on Twitter and Sina Weibo in China and all these other places. So just suddenly, every newspaper in the world is publishing pictures of Jeremy Lin, who had been completely unknown on February 3rd, mm-hmm. outside of a very narrow circle.
Yeah. Yeah. So tell me about his faith, too, because you had a chance on that dark, stormy night at Harvard to talk about him. You kind of described him as a scrappy guy who's, you know, tough on the court. I guess he probably had to be because, you know, he's in an environment that, you know, everybody would put him down. So that's going to kind of, you know, sharpen your edges a little bit. But what about his spiritual faith? What can you tell us about there?
Well, the great thing about Jeremy is that he really is. He's the real deal. He is a very good-hearted person, a very humble person. We kept in touch. I did another interview during his first season with the Warriors, or I guess it was at the kind of beginning of that season. And his faith is largely reformed. The churches he grew up attending were Chinese-American Christian churches that were not denominationally defined, but the people who were always his greatest mentors were reformed in their theology. So you hear Jeremy talk a lot about God's sovereignty, about how God, you know, orchestrated the whole thing. And that's not him just kind of making some blithe comment. That's very much rooted in his theology and the way that he sees the world, as everything is ordained. Everything that happens is a part of the, you know, is written by the great author. And so he sees his story that way. One of the more interesting things is that toward the end of his high school career, one of my colleagues from Stanford became the pastor there to the youth group at that church that he grew up at, Chinese Christian Church, Christian Church. It's in the Palo Alto area. And he started a ministry in East Palo Alto, which is one of the... was formerly the murder capital of the United States, had the highest level of murders per capita. And very right across from Palo Alto, which is wealthy and privileged, but a pretty stark contrast. So he, and I can't use his name because he does ministry overseas in an unsafe place, but he went with his wife to live in that neighborhood and kind of minister and be a Christian presence in that neighborhood. And Jeremy went and was a part of a summer ministry there that was reaching out to the kids in the neighborhood. And he just really connected with the kids over basketball, found that because of his basketball prowess, he had immediate street cred with them, and they would listen to him in a way that they wouldn't if he were not this great basketball player. So that really shaped Jeremy, that he decided that he really wanted to use the platform that basketball gave him to have an impact with kids. And so you'll see when he travels internationally or things he does here in the United States, he often does speak openly about his faith, but he also often just does things for kids that are kind of on the down low. And he started his own foundation as well that will focus on that.
Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, I that's kind of interesting. So he's doing this kind of as a, you know, I felt a calling for this. I want to help out these low-income kids in an area that I grew up in, and I have the ability to do this. So God's hand is kind of directing me in terms of this. And, you know, when people are interviewing him after the big games and all that kind of thing, he makes no secret that he's a Christian. And he's not necessarily Tebowing on the basketball court, right? So he's not, I would say, as overt of a Christian that many people would say Tim Tebow is. But my big question is that, again, this happens at a time when Tim Tebow is under a lot of criticism for just being a in-your-face Christian on the football field. You know, he had just led Denver Broncos to the playoffs, you know, and then a month later, Jeremy Lin explodes onto the scene. You had an opportunity to see both of this, and from your vantage point as an elite Christian athlete, what do you think is going on? You kind of compare and contrast what's going on with Tebow and what's going on with Lin.
Well, it's a very interesting comparison, because I don't know if I would say that Tebow is more overt.
I would agree with you on that, and I should correct myself, but the media makes it seem that way.
It does.
Yeah.
It does. And it's interesting to consider, you know, how kind of racial stereotypes might play into that.
Mm-hmm.
Because the stereotype is that Asian Americans, in particular Asian American males, can be kind of quiet and just keep to themselves and
right.
don't really, you know, speak up all that much. But Jeremy is very, it's exceedingly rare for him to have a press avail without mentioning God mm-hmm. and his gratitude to God. And you mentioned this, the one distinction is that he doesn't have kind of this famous, you know, gesture, Tebowing, kneeling down and praying. He does frequently, you know, point skyward and thank God. And he very often just goes into sometimes surprising detail and speak at great length about his faith and how grateful he is to God for victory. And that's actually one way in which he's even more overt. Tim Tebow will rarely thank God for the victory. He thanks God for the opportunity, for kind of putting him in position and giving him the talents that he's got. He rarely speaks as though God gave him the victory or God helped him to make a shot. Jeremy is much more likely, and I think this is due to his theology, much more likely to talk about God orchestrating things. And so one thing that you often heard about Tim Tebow that was positive from skeptics was, well, at least he doesn't thank God for the victory. As though God cares about football and as though God really, you know, orchestrates who wins a game. But Jeremy does, and he got a little bit of criticism from that, but very muted. In some respects, if you're in, and I spent, because of where I took my degrees, I'd spent time in a lot of settings that were largely secular and largely critical toward Christianity. It's in a lot of ways more acceptable to be a minority evangelical than a white evangelical. You're less likely to be criticized, especially if you're an African-American evangelical, then, you know, nobody's going to criticize that. But if you're a white evangelical and kind of come from a white, you know, middle-class setting, then there are a lot of assumptions that are just placed on your shoulders. Tebow, too, has been more outspoken on social issues. So, you know, he had his famous commercial that was put together with Focus on the Family regarding abortion, where his mother simply told the story of choosing to have her child, doesn't even use the word abortion or anything like that. But so I think Tebow gets some of the anger directed towards social conservatives that Jeremy does not. Now, Jeremy, in his high school, and I don't know how many people know this, I came across it when I was reading through everything that was written about Jeremy in his high school, the various kind of high school newspapers from his high school, that he was involved in a demonstration that the school was having an anti-hate week. And some of the Christians felt that it was equating, you know, criticism of homosexuality with hate toward homosexuality. And so some of the Christians, including Jeremy, was a part of this Christian group at the high school, participated in kind of a counter-protest sort of thing. And Jeremy is, you know, on the record speaking to that newspaper saying that, you know, we love our homosexual friends even though we think that, you know, that is not the will of God. And so Jeremy, you know, there are pictures of him there kind of holding these signs and stuff. So he's not, people talk sometimes, and there was a piece in the New York Times saying that Jeremy is not this culture warrior. And that's by and large true, but Jeremy probably has the same views on these things that Tim Tebow does. He just hasn't actually made a commercial with Focus on the Family. So that's one of the key differences as well, I think.
Well, we're getting near the end of our podcast here, and we didn't quite get to one of the areas that I really wanted to go in depth in, which is the state of Christianity in America today, because that that's a whole different can of worms, and I'm sure we could talk another hour about that. So I'm going to invite you back again in a few weeks to talk about that. But I do want to connect this to Jeremy Lin and to Tim Tebow, because rarely a week goes by where you don't see some article in the newspaper saying, oh, America's becoming less Christian. There's more atheists. There's more people not affiliated. There's youth groups or youth are disenfranchised with institutional religion and they're falling away from the faith, et cetera, et cetera. And I talk to a lot of my evangelical friends and they think the end is coming, right? The end of Christian America is just weeks away with all this bad news. But then you get something like Tim Tebow or Jeremy Lin. And it's not only Jeremy Lin, his story that it's kind of a Rudy that everybody's rooting for the 11th guy to come off and do a, you know, show up the big superstars. But it's also, it was connected very much with his Christianity. And I have friends that just loved the Denver Broncos and Tim Tebow, not because they love football, but because he was a Christian. And the same thing with Jeremy Lin. I think there was this great aspect about it. Does the fact that there has been such a rally around Tebow and a rally around Jeremy Lin and to a lesser extent, Albert Pujols and a few other athletes, Gabby Douglas, gymnastics in the Olympics. Is that telling us that Christianity is still alive and kicking and there is a great thirst for having heroes who are Christians in the United States? Or is this just a small and decreasing minority that's grasping at the last straw of their faith, and it's just going to be snuffed out in the next month? What's your take on that, given that you're with Patheos and you see this big umbrella of all these stories all the time?
Well, like you, and I think you could make the case as well or better than I could, I think that even just on the sociology, even just looking at the data, there's a great case to be made that the dissolution of Christianity has been wildly exaggerated, and that the rise of atheism and the nuns, the non-affiliateds, has been over-interpreted when you have a very, very small segment of the populace and a number of kind of books coming out that seem kind of make it cool to be atheist. Of course, you're going to have an increase in, and atheists are, there are an awful lot of young men who find that that's what they want to be.
Yeah.
They want to be atheists. And
yeah, it's been historically true, yeah.
Yeah, when you see it online, and I get comments from a lot of atheists on my blog, and a lot of them are kind of pubescent men, to be honest. But what you find, too, is that in these studies about who is kind of staying within the tradition in which they were raised, that very few, actually. There's a very high rate of people who are raised atheist but leave it and become religious, and many of them becoming Christian. So there's just a lot of movement. There's a lot of movement within Christianity, between denominations. So a lot of denominations, we can cite figures that say, oh, this denomination lost this amount. But a lot of them are just going to other denominations or to non-denominational groups, and some of those non-affiliateds are non-denominational. That's on the statistical level. Anecdotally, America loves its Christian athletes, doesn't it? I mean, middle America does.
Yeah, yeah.
There seems to be kind of this level of scorn in elite media that is kind of always waiting to jump out with some kind of criticism of these Christian athletes. But I do think that, A, it's important to have these examples of people who are courageous people of faith. Great for kids to see people like that, especially if all they're hearing is that, you know, Christianity is dying, and you see somebody who is proud of their faith and living out their faith. And the great thing about the people you've mentioned, especially Tebow and Jeremy Lin and Albert Pujols, all of them are expressing their faith in service to others. Tebow is famous for this, and it's one reason why it's been very hard for those who would be inclined to criticize him, actually to criticize him, because he does extraordinary things helping kids who are in the midst of, you know, great trial. And Jeremy, with his heart for kids in the inner city. Albert Pujols has a great foundation that does great work. So all of these are fantastic examples. So A, it's important. B, it is a sign, I think, not a miraculous sign, but a sign that there is still great vitality, and it seems like an increasing number of publicly Christian athletes. And I think it's partly grows out of the strength of a number of Christian ministries that focus on athletes as well. So I do think there's a sign of vitality here in the fact that they have been so embraced and so celebrated by a broad cross-section of Americans.
Well, I think that is a great way to wrap up everything. And Tim, I want to thank you for being on Research on Religion. I want to have you back in the future to talk about some other things that we see on Patheos. How's that sound?
Oh, that sounds great. Thanks very much. My pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.